Today is August 5th, 2007, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, morning editor for TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, editor-in-chief. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at awr@macobserver.com or phone 206-202-0647. That's our new phone number.
We have a mix of iPhone and Mac-related news this week, starting with the state of New York, which doesn't exactly care for Apple's industrial and user design approach to the iPhone. Apple has not yet publicly responded to New York's complaints, but the company did announce that it will make a Mac-related announcement on August 7th. In other news, the company's stock went up and down this week like a Ritalin junkie on a pogo stick, and the company had good news and less than good news in the world of security.
Our top story this week comes from New York State, where State Consumer Protection Board isn't so sure Apple's made the right decision when it comes to iPhone design. The board took particular exception to the fact that the iPhone's battery isn't user-replaceable, in a letter to Steve Jobs asked that Apple revisit this and fix the problem.
More specifically, Mindy Bockstein, Consumer Protection Board Chairwoman and Executive Director, stated in a letter, "I encourage Apple to redesign the iPhone in order to provide for a replaceable battery."
The board also wants Apple to abandon its 10% restocking fee and review how it presents contract terms and conditions, warranties, and return policy information to customers. We'll be talking about these issues in the Context Machine.
In other iPhone news, the Houston Chronicle's Dwight Silverman wrote one of the few negative reviews published so far about the iPhone. Chief among his complaints is the lack of Microsoft Exchange support for email, JavaScript issues in Safari, the slowness of the Edge connection in his area, and he didn't like the virtual keyboard.
On Tuesday, TheStreet.com reported that an analyst with Miller Tabak & Company had issued a research note saying Apple had cut back iPhone production, news that sent the company's stock down more than 3%. The only problem with this is that Miller Tabak & Company told CNBC and other media outlets that they had issued no such research note. Peter Pukvar, a trader at the firm, commented, quote, "We weren't issuing any kind of report. We don't have an Apple analyst," unquote.
Though Apple stock recovered some of its losses the following day, it continued to rise and fall throughout the week, ending at $131.85, down $12.48, or a loss of 8.6% for the week.
That didn't stop Richard Gardner of Citigroup from upgrading Apple to a buy with a target price of $160 per share. Breaking down his outlook on Apple stock, Mr. Gardner said that a, quote, worst-case near-term downside, unquote, for investors would be a pullback to $115, but that he saw a low probability that such a pullback would occur. On the upside, he sees a high for this stock of $160 per share and said, quote, "We would increase positions at current levels and simply use any near-term weaknesses to buy more shares."
And on to Mac news. On Wednesday, Apple began inviting journalists to an on-campus Mac-related media event to be held Tuesday, August 7th. Mum's the word on details other than the specific Mac-related tidbit we were treated to, but a follow-up story from the Wall Street Journal on Friday noted that Steve Jobs, the iCEO himself, will be there for the event. Of course, since Mr. Jobs usually helms these events in person, that shouldn't be a surprise, but it has seemed to whet the appetites of Apple watchers everywhere.
In more macOS 10 news, the Open Group officially certified macOS 10 Leopard, the upcoming major upgrade to macOS 10, as being 100% Unix. This is a change for the operating system, which was officially supposed to be described as quote-unquote Unix-based, though to most folks who bothered to pay attention at all, it was already simply a Unix operating system.
As pointed out by a guest post at the Mac Observer, the most far-reaching effect the certification will have is for the, and I quote our guest poster, "mindless, pencil-neck, bureaucratic drones with no knowledge of IT that make government procurement decisions."
Well, surely said with love.
Surely. And speaking of love, Microsoft and Apple announced at TypeCon 2007 this week that the two companies were renewing their font cross-licensing agreements. The joint announcement said, quote, Under the agreement, Apple and Microsoft are extending the seamless web and software experience Apple users have enjoyed for years when using and viewing popular Microsoft fonts such as Times New Roman, Arial, and Verdana. Apple customers, developers, and web designers can safely specify fonts knowing that their documents, presentations, and web pages will appear as they are meant to be seen on screen and in print.
Moving on to security, Dr. Charles Miller of Independent Security Evaluators slammed Apple's security practices at the Black Hat Briefings Conference held in Las Vegas this week. Mr. Miller garnered headlines in July when he announced that his team had developed an exploit that could commandeer an iPhone through a Wi-Fi connection or by enticing an iPhone user to visit a maliciously crafted web page in Safari.
Dr. Miller withheld details about the exploit until Apple patched the hole, but he said there are deeper problems with Apple's security practices. Most notably, he said the company has a bad habit of using open source code with known vulnerabilities, even though updates to that code that patch those vulnerabilities have long since been released.
Because of this, Dr. Miller offered what he called a formula for finding a zero-day vulnerability in Mac OS X or OS X. Quote, first, find an open source package that they use that's out of date. There's plenty of those. Read through the changelog for the current version of that software, find a usable bug that's been fixed in the newer versions, and you're done. You don't have to worry about static analysis or fuzzing or any of that stuff.
Mr. Miller, a self-described Mac fan who loves his iPhone, said that Apple needs to improve its security practices, or the next folks that exploit these old issues may be bad guys with bad intent and not security researchers who give Apple time to patch the problem.
And finally this week, we have what we find to be a humorous story on Apple security. David Mayner and John Elk were both given a Pony Award. That's spelled P-W-N-I-E at this year's Black Hat Conference for their supposed hack for taking over a Mac. They had demonstrated said hack at last year's Black Hat Conference by video, but in the intervening time, their fellow hackers deciding that it was never substantiated, and thus the two have been pwned by their peers.
Pwned.
Pwned. It's time for the Context Machine, where Jeff and I delve a little more deeply into the news to provide context for what's going on. First up, why don't we talk about something we didn't talk about in the news because it really wasn't newsworthy, but there was an article in the Reg basically calling Apple's iPhone launch event a failure.
You know, I'd be interested in knowing just exactly what these people are ingesting to come up with this whole theory that Apple totally failed with the iPhone launch. From my perspective, that's not what happened.
Well, let's actually listen to some of his words. This was a piece by effectively an anonymous poster at the Reg, or anonymous writer, I should say, because he's going by his handle of Faultline. He said, Apple's declaration that only 146,000 Apple iPhones registered on its network in the first 2 days it was on the market has led to widespread shock at what is now being seen as devices failure in a down period for Apple shares, sliding 7.5% over a few days last week, a fall of some $10 billion in total market capitalization. This is one time no one can forgive Apple. In the past, it has executed launches so well that it has become, what is he saying here, metronomic and surprise-free. It might be that this was a result of the problems that people had once they had bought their devices, getting home and finding that it was almost impossible to sign up with AT&T, blah, 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 blah. The launch event itself was not a failure. It was the exact opposite of a failure. The company had almost the perfect amount of inventory, some 270,000 units in the channel.
You know, when I look at the phrasing, the word choice in this, look at that. I'm actually speechless for a moment. That doesn't happen very often. Now, I'm just not getting why Faultline is calling this a failure. I mean, other than maybe they have a bone to pick with Apple. I don't know. But what I saw was a clockwork launch. I mean, everything went off smoothly. There was enough product to get into the people's hands. And I didn't see that so much as an issue with not enough people buying the iPhone, but more of an issue where Apple was able to have enough stock on hand to meet the demand.
Well, you know, Apple had said they intended to sell 1 million this calendar year. So in other words, before the end of the September quarter, they were going to sell a million. They put 270,000 of these things into the channel. 146,000 of them got activated, which, as we've said before, I believe that they probably sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 to 220. You could go 180 if you want to be really negative. But, you know, a lot of folks were buying these things, and they weren't necessarily activated right out of the box. And AT&T had some activation issues. So, again, the company sold basically what it intended to. Apple has since reiterated its target of selling a million before the end of the calendar year, which would basically mean another 730,000 that they intend to push into the channel before the end of the quarter. So, you know, everything is on target. Yes, some of the analysts out there got a little bit wacky with their predictions and their goals, but it's, you know, it went pretty much perfectly. And I'm sorry to monopolize the mic, Jeff, but, you know, when we look at where Apple has been criticized for launch events in the past, it's been for not having enough product to meet demand. And that hasn't really happened in the last couple of years. So, you know, I fail to see the problem here, and I think it's kind of interesting to read this kind of take.
You know, I'm seeing kind of a spin to what Faultline wrote, and I think he, she, whoever, was really keying in on these crazy inflated projections that some of the analysts were coming up with, you know, 500,000 in a day and a half, which is basically what they had for sales time. I mean, that's just insane to have expected that and then to follow up and assume that's what everyone was really projecting when it was just really a pie in the sky number that a couple analysts came up with.
Yeah, and even those projections were pulled back in the subsequent days. You know, that first week, basically, we saw the projections go up and then come back down. So I don't think there's just not a lot of meat to this kind of outlook on that launch event. It's really not even a lot to complain about when it comes to AT&T's announcement. Again, clearly Apple sold about as many units as they expected to sell. And that's pretty much a good thing. Now, to be fair to Faultline, he's not clearly just a straight Apple basher. The rest of this little article that he put together says very nice things about the iPhone itself, and he talks a lot about people buying these things and carrying them back to Europe to use as iPhone as iPods until they can get some kind of service.
Right.
So I mean, he's not an Apple basher. It's just kind of a weird take, and I thought it was definitely worth discussing.
You know, I'm sure someone will bring it up in comments to today's podcast, so I'll go ahead and mention it now. What about the possibility that Faultline is just looking for hits on the site?
That's always a possibility, sure. But I think if he was going to pull a Dvorak, he would have had the entire article talk about how Apple's going to be failing and the iPhone's complete, you know.
Right, the world failure, is collapsing. Right. Okay.
And, you know, one more small point on this, too, is that some of the mainstream journalists that had talked to me before the iPhone event for background on their story, yeah, they were all looking at Apple. Like, one of them asked me if Apple needed to sell more than 50,000 to call the iPhone a success. And, again, that question, you know, looking at that first weekend one way or another, no matter how good or how bad it is not the real indicator. The real indicator is this quarter, next quarter, and next quarter. But, I mean, you know, I just think it's relevant to hark back to before the event and remember that 100, 150, 200,000 units was actually, you know, going to be a really great launch event.
Right. And Apple clearly hit the numbers to make this, at least in some people's mind, a successful launch.
Yeah, absolutely agreed.
But you're right. You can't call it a successful product after a day and a half worth of sales.
No. And you can't call it a failed product for the same reason.
That's absolutely correct. If you look at so many of the other products that, and not just from Apple, but from all kinds of companies, they've released products and they didn't take off right away, but then they ramped up later on and were successful products.
Well, at least in the iPod line, yeah.
Well, sure. And I think the iPhone took off with a really nice start. And my guess, just based on what I've seen in the Apple stores that I've gone into since the launch, it's probably going to do just fine.
Yeah, I think that it will. You know, looking forward, if we want to understand how the iPhone is doing as a product, whether or not Apple's investment in this market has been worth it, whether or not it was worth it to pull all those development resources off of Leopard and put them on the iPhone, we're going to need to see if they're on track for selling the 10 million in calendar year 2008. Their fiscal 2008. That's going to be the real key. Can they sell 2.5 million a quarter on average?
And seeing what numbers they show us for the end of their fiscal year, with everything through September, that's going to help us at least get a guideline of whether or not Apple is going to be able to sustain that. Of course, it's just the one quarter, but at least it's a good start.
Yep, absolutely. So let's move on to my other favorite topic this week, and that is, of course, the state of New York. We're not so sure about this whole iPhone thing.
Yeah, how about that? One issue that I have, just right up front, I have a problem with government agencies trying to control exactly how a company designs its product at the aesthetic level. I can understand putting controls in place like don't coat your products with arsenic or cyanide. Okay, that's something that I'll grant them.
That's reasonable.
Totally reasonable. But turning around and saying, you know, we don't like how you designed your product with its battery, so go ahead and change that for us now. That's kind of out there.
Right. I mean, I am very much of a libertarian persuasion, despite the fact that many of our readers over the years have accused me of being everything from a leftist to a fascist. You know, it's depending on the week or what I'm writing about. I'm very much on the libertarian side of things. The government needs to get out of our face. The government needs to protect the environment, build some roads, manage education, provide for the common defense, that sort of thing. However, I do believe that there is a role for government to play in regulating commerce, for instance, going after predatory monopolistic practices like, say, Microsoft did.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that I think that Microsoft has over the past three decades caused enormous harm to the economy, to the world of technology. They have stifled innovation. They have really, really hurt the entire world with their business practices and the crappy ass software, pardon my language, with the exception of the Mac business unit, whom I love. So there is a place for government management of the economy. However, if they want to go after Apple's business practices, that's fine. I don't really think Apple's doing anything wrong. But let's say that this protection board was talking about the fact that Apple has made the phone not portable. It's closed. You can't take it from AT&T to Verizon if you want. So if they want to go after Apple for that, well, that's a subjective thing, and you know, that's something that certainly warrants merit. But when it comes to this particular product, you know, there's nothing that is not thought out in this product. The reason why it is so cool, the reason why I've dropped mine a couple times and haven't heard it. And the reason why that sort of thing is possible is because Apple has designed this really, really well. And I think that the marketplace can decide whether or not the lack of a replaceable battery is enough of an issue not to buy it.
Yeah, I agree that there are certain places where it's okay for the government to get involved and offer guidelines for health, safety, just the general public welfare. But there's also places where where the government really doesn't need to get involved. And in a case like this, where they're trying to convince a company to change a product because they don't like the aesthetics, that's not right. And that's not anything that they need to be involved in.
I wouldn't say that they're complaining about the aesthetics of the iPhone. It's more like, from their perspective, users should be able to replace the battery, and you shouldn't have to pay a company to replace it for you. As a matter of fact, I think one of their quotes was that a high-end phone shouldn't require low-level service. And that's, again, I think that the marketplace can decide this particular issue. I think that it's you know, just as with the iPod, where people also complained about the lack of user replaceable batteries, that the market is going to be just fine with it. And I think that since you can't separate the complete design aesthetic from these kinds of issues. I mean, it would really change the nature of the iPhone if the battery had to be user accessible. It would be bigger. It would be less sturdy. I mean, that's just all there is to it. And I really think that they're wrong in this particular case.
Thank you very much for fleshing out my thought on that one. That's exactly where I was going. And I think you said it far more eloquently than I was going to. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm here for you, man. I'm always here for you.
I appreciate that. I'm glad someone has my back.
Absolutely.
And that particular riff means it's time for the request line, the segment where we talk about the topics that you pick. This week's request line topic comes from Jim, who wanted to know more about the security criticisms coming from Dr. Charles Miller.
Ooh, you know, that's a good topic. Thanks for writing in, Jim. We very much appreciate it. You know, what Dr. Miller is saying here is it's kind of a serious charge.
Yeah, you know, it is. Basically, what it looks like to me, anyhow, is that he's accusing Apple of being very lax with its stance on operating system security.
Yeah, I'd even go so far as to call it sloppy. Assuming that, now you have to understand that we're talking about what Dr. Miller has said. We haven't researched this. We are not coding experts. You know, I'm not well versed in the minutia of the open source world. So, you know, it's certainly possible that Dr. Miller could be wrong. But again, talking about what he said, Apple including outdated open source code is indeed sloppy if that turns out to be the case.
You know, another thing that we'll have to keep in mind is that Apple is very tight-lipped about what they're doing with security before they actually release an update. So if Apple is taking old code, that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't applying their own patches to it. We don't know.
Well, actually, though, it's open source. So if they're using open source code, they've got to document what they're doing, and any fixes they make have to be released out back as open source.
That's true. That's a very good point, which I should have been thinking of earlier. But you know, there are so many things that we don't actually hear coming out of this because Apple won't talk about what they're doing before they actually do it, and that
right.
makes it difficult to defend Apple's stance on the code that they're incorporating into the operating system or into any of their other software products. And it does also make it very easy for Dr. Miller to make his claims, and then there's no one from Apple coming back saying, well, actually, take a look at this, this, and this. That's not going to happen.
Well, you know, and I don't even know. I mean, the only real defense against this particular kind of charge would simply be, well, no, you're wrong. You know, for instance, he mentioned Samba. He said that the version of Samba that was being used is, if I remember correctly, the version they're using is from February of 2005, and it's basically had some issues that have since been fixed. So the only way for Apple to refute that would be to say, well, no, you're wrong. We're using this particular version of Samba, and, you know, there are no known vulnerabilities with it. So, you know, that's really the only kind of defense. Either the company's doing these things or they're not doing these things. If they are including code that is out of date, that has known vulnerabilities, quite frankly, my opinion is that they've got to change that.
That's a really good point. And, you know, what I was trying to do here, just to see if I could make it work, I was trying to take a defensive stance in favor of Apple. And frankly, without them coming forward and saying, this is exactly what we're doing and Dr. Miller is wrong, wow, I really can't defend the company on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I don't know that this is ever the kind of thing they would own up to or not own up to or even address. I think that they'll either deal with it or they won't deal with it. And that's just the way it is. Now, there's another thing is that I think that he's correct that if they don't fix this stuff, that the next people to develop the exploits are going to be the bad guys.
Right, and that's definitely not something we want. I really have no desire to live in a world that parallels what Microsoft Windows users deal with, where they can't get virus and security update patches quick enough to keep up with what the bad guys are doing.
Right. You know, and we should let's delve into this a little bit further. As you know, I absolutely believe that Apple has security in mind when it comes to developing their solutions. I believe that that's the case. I think that they have proven that over time. They certainly have been very quick to come out with security patches when issues have been pointed out. And I think that Apple's entire approach to security is at least as good as Microsoft's and probably far, far, far better. You know, one of the in the story that we referenced, one of the security guys that the reporters had talked to said that Microsoft tends not to deal with anything until it's complained about, whereas Apple will systematically go after things that they know about and fix them whether or not they've been complained about. And I believe that that's absolutely the case. I think that the security record we have with Mac OS X so far is not a fluke. Again, if there are any outdated bits of code, that's just got to be fixed.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I agree that Apple is most likely looking at security from a very proactive standpoint. Although if they're using outdated code, okay, well, that's something that really does need to be addressed. And I suppose it's possible that when they start a project, they use whatever code is available and then stick with it until the project is completed instead of trying to revise that along the way. However, I don't see that as an excuse.
No, and we're not going to pretend that we know exactly how Apple is working on anything. You know, that's just not really possible to talk about unless you're within the company. And you know, this guy's comments, Dr. Miller's comments, are the first of its kind that I've heard from anyone. You know, he could be wrong. He could absolutely and positively be wrong. My gut feeling is that he's not. I don't think that this is an issue that's systemic within OS X or Mac OS X, but I think that there probably are some areas where Apple has let this sort of thing slide. Again, not that I know. It's just my gut feeling. I don't think this guy is after headlines. I think this guy is actually concerned about these issues, and he wants to see it changed.
You know, and that's actually great if that's what he's doing. And I'm not doubting him or questioning his motives, because there's no point doing that right now. But it is nice to see that he's going from this from a standpoint of, look, here's an issue. What can we do to fix it? As opposed to, hey, I found this problem, and I'm going to be the next Mac hacksaw, and screw all you. I'm going to take your MacBooks down.
Exactly. This guy is a legitimate researcher with a legitimate security firm, at least as far as I can tell. And we'll see where this goes. If this brings about any kind of positive change, I think, pardon me, folks, if this brings about any kind of positive change, I think this will be, you know, really good for the platform. And no one loses if security is improved, except the bad guys.
And it's okay for them to lose.
Indeed. Well, that is the request line. If there's something you would like to hear Jeff and me discuss in the Context Machine, shoot us a note at awr@macobserver.com or call 206-202-0647. Remember, that's our new phone number. And let us know what you think. And as always, we'll close the Context Machine with listener comments. This week, our listener comments come from TMO members Injun Joe and Snob4, who want to know where Ricky Spiro went.
Injun Joe wrote, "Out of curiosity, whatever happened to Ricky Spiro? He basically dropped out of the picture around WWDC, which I figured was due to the on-site coverage, but he remained absent for the 6 or so weeks since. Not that I disapprove of Brian's contributions, of course."
Well, thanks, Injun Joe, but Snob4 had another comment saying, "I remember Jeff announcing that Ricky was being sent off to, quote-unquote, summer camp, but there was no other explanation. The podcast sounded a whole lot better when he was on the audio tech end of it." That's Ricky. "Now there's a whole lot of background noise, and Brian's voice sounds real muddy, garbled. When is Ricky coming back?"
Well, the sad news is that Ricky isn't coming back to co-host the show. He's moved on to other things, though we will be having him on the show as a guest from time to time.
Ricky had originally stepped away during the summer for a trip to Europe, hence our jokes about summer camp, and during that trip he decided to permanently leave the show that he created. In the meanwhile, I've officially joined the Apple Weekly Report as co-host with Jeff. As for the sound issues that Snob 4 mentioned, we are working very hard on that, and we hope that this particular episode of the Apple Weekly Report sounded substantially better than the last few. Without Ricky helming the production side of things, we've had a bit of a learning curve, but we certainly hope to continue the excellent tradition of quality he started.
Yes, we do, and we appreciate hearing from you. And if you have anything to comment on, add, or question, send your audio or text comments to awr@macobserver.com or phone at 206-202-0647. And remember, succinctness is next to steveliness. And that's this week's Apple Weekly Report. Thank you for listening, and thanks for sending us your comments and feedback.
Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded for TMO. That's all for this week.
And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer and iPodObserver.com.